Hello, tis I, DJ Tangent, Queens alumnus and community member, host of Numbers with Wings on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Sunday afternoons at 2 p.m. How did I get into this? Funnily enough, it was at a fundraising a couple of years ago, doing a dad joke contest with DJ Over Easy, then a couple of guest spots on his show, and they gave me my own show. Nothing beats the thrill of a live broadcast. I like to promote new Canadian and local music while also sharing songs from my past. Our funding drive runs from November to December 31st. Donations can be made via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support of CFRC 101.9 FM.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, Image plus Nation, supporting LGBTQ plus cinema and culture for four decades. That and more next. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to be a voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto. And together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So, today, Image plus Nation, or more commonly known, Imagination, a Montreal-based queer film and culture festival, now in its 38th year. And joining me to talk about the 38th edition of Imagination is Executive Director Charlie Boudreau and Programming Director Kat Setzer. We'll find out what we can expect at the 38th edition of Imagination. Plus, later in the hour, my interview with Oscar-winning gay filmmaker Alejandro Amenábar, who joins me to talk about his latest film, The Captive, a film that tells the 16th century story of Miguel de Cervantes, the man who would go on to be the author of the foundational masterpiece, Don Quixote. By the way, The Captive will be part of this year's Imagination lineup. And in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey to Rainbow Country. So, when I return, Image plus Nation.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Charlie Boudreau. Hi, how are you?
Hello, how are you doing today?
I am well, I am well. Kat Setzer.
Mm-hmm.
Bonjour, comment ça va?
I am also doing well. Thank you for asking.
Well, I have to say thank you both for being here. Okay, so let's just jump right in. Image plus nation or imagination. A cinema and culture festival runs from November 20th to the 30th in Montreal. 2025 marks its 30th year. Charlie Boudreau, you are the executive director. Can you give us a bit of history and essentially what this film festival, this cultural event, is all about?
Well, as many festivals started in this time ago, so in 1987, you can imagine what kind of representations there were of queer people on screen, LGBT people on screen. So we started a festival to give ourselves our own voice. In this sense, we were showing films that existed, but it also helped to fuel the want to create more films that talk about our realities. So this is 38 years ago, and look at where we are now. So we've witnessed this amazing evolution of how we talk about ourselves. And this also reflects how our place in society or in culture has changed. And the comfort with which one can move away from those days to some degree, not at all to say that everything is one and everything is equal. That's not what I mean. But we are able now to have films that have more nuance, more complexity, that touch more the cinematography, a notion of cinema, I'm trying to say, rather than message-based films. So it's been a beautiful journey. I've been here for about 30 years of this.
Wow. Kat Setzer, you are the programming director for Imagination. What can audiences expect at the 38th edition of this film festival and cultural event?
We have quite a remarkable roster of films this year. Coming at this stage where we're in the last minutes of production and, you know, making sure the website is together and the catalog, one gets to see an overview and a whole kind of picture of what the lay of the land with the programming is. And I have to say, I'm really impressed with the work that is shown. We have, this year we have a spotlight on Indigiqueer Two-Spirit work, Stories and Storytellers. Our opening film actually launches that spotlight by Gail Maurice, titled Bloodlines. Interestingly, we opened the festival in 2022 with Gail's debut feature called Rosie. In addition, in that focus, we have a film, pardon me, called At the Place of Ghosts by director Brett Hannon, who again also launched his debut feature called Wildhood with us in 2021. So just having those two and being able to kind of follow the evolution of their expanding remarkable careers is really something that we're quite proud of. Included in in the Indigiqueer spotlight is a gorgeous documentary called Rising Through the Fray by Courtney Montour, which tracks a borderless Indigenous roller derby team, which is also just like, you know, I say no more. It's fantastic. And as well, a drag musical from Corey Payette, who is a Vancouver-based creator, works in theater, but this is a film, and it's called Star Walker. So that is our utmost spotlight for this year. Included, we also have a number of focuses that really include some remarkable work, one called Voix Emergente, Emerging Voices, which is a focus in which we highlight works that come from places and perspectives that have up until now had very little representation in the queer cinema canon. For instance, we have titles from Croatia, Herzegovina, Bosnia, and those are some wonderful titles. A few that come to mind right now, Sandbag Dam is a really wonderful film. It I think it actually got the Teddy at the Berlinale this year. Another one called Beautiful Evening, Beautiful Day. I'm just trying to think. And many. Sorry, not to take up the airtime with that. As well, we have Mado Canada, which is a constant focus, one of our signature focuses, which, as you can imagine, is work from Canadian creators. And that is unique because I believe you air across the country, correct?
Mm-hmm, indeed.
Yeah, because that programming is, much of it is available pan-Canadian on our virtual platform, our shorts program. Our shorts programming, for instance. So that's a chance for folks across the country to see some of what we have to offer. I can go on, but I think I'm taking up a little bit too much time.
Well, you just mentioned some titles. You've got Bloodlines. You've got At the Place of Ghosts. I believe also, too, The Captive is part of this year's lineup. I have to say, to toot my own horn, all of those filmmakers from those films that I've just mentioned have all been here on Rainbow Country. Charlie, talk to me about the importance of a festival, a cultural event like Imagination when it comes to giving a platform, when it comes to giving voice to queer filmmakers and queer artists. How important is it to have platforms like Imagination for giving voice to the LGBT community? Can you talk to me about that? The importance of that?
Well, yes, I certainly can. As I mentioned in the intro of our chat, it is important to have our own place, to have our own voices. It is authenticity, which is the base of all representation. And when we speak of representation is powerful. It is us telling our stories and sharing them, because it's also about creating a place where these films can be shared and seen by everyone. And especially in these particular times, this historical moment where we're embarking in a time where difference is not appreciated, it's more and more important for queer film festivals to exist and to give a place for these voices to exist, to be heard and shared, as I said. So we're very important right now. We've always been very important. I'm also a big believer in what they call niche festivals, instead of, you know, always focusing on general festivals that have a bit of this and a bit of that. This is queer, this is Black Film Festival, this is like other, because we scour the world for the best of what exists in terms of representation, and we bring it to audiences. So we not only get to see Canadian stories, we get to go to Croatia, as Kat said, we get to go to many, many countries. So not only do we see other people's experience, which all of this is helpful for building empathy, which is the key of everything in humanity, it helps us travel too. So we're discovering other cultures, traveling a bit, and seeing how, like, just discovering other stories from other people around here and around the world. So I think all of this is very important. So not only do we have excellent films, we can also travel and learn a bit and share these stories.
So, Kat, the next question is for yourself, and it's essentially about the depth of the talent pool in when it comes to creating, you know, queer films, especially here in Canada, and how you as as a programmer looking for those films, those short films, those documentaries, how are you finding the talent pool when it comes to making those projects? Are you finding it challenging? Are you finding it it's plentiful when it comes to being able to source out those films, specifically Canadian films? How do you see the talent pool when it comes to Canadian queer films in regards to the filmmakers?
Right. That's a really great question. Specifically in terms of a Canadian talent pool, and I really like that. I like going back to talent pool. That's excellent. I mentioned a few of the titles that are indigiqueer focus, and it's wonderful that you've highlighted those films on your show already, because so you agree as well that they are really remarkable works. I think that Canadian queer cinema has gone through a winding path. You know, there's a moment, what kind of going back to what Charlie was saying, giving a brief history of our festival. I think that the journey of queer cinema and queer cinema creators has also followed that similar path. You know, in 1987, the work was really about representation on a screen. It was really video based. There was a lot of DIY. There was just based on the access to the means of production, which were extremely difficult. Also, the access to the means of production in terms of the ways to get films made, you know, i.e. money. So that evolution has also followed the evolution of our festival. And I think queer representation, too, when the means of production become more accessible to us, the projects get larger. You know, when funding opens up, the projects also get larger. So we've had the privilege of witnessing this development of really the Canadian queer media landscape just kind of explode in the last number of years, certainly in the last decade, in terms of the quality and the multitude of narrative feature that has been made, as well documentary. I mean, Canada's always had the corner on exceptional short filmmaking, and in particular, Quebec has, you know, this incredible rich history of wonderful, wonderful shorts that we've included at our festival for decades as well. But I really am getting quite excited with the development in particular in terms of queer cinema over the last decade, 5 years, for sure.
And if I may add, like, also, Kat, like, we used to have to struggle to find films, Canadian films, to show in the festival, and now we have... We have an abundance that we sadly have to, we can't show them all. So we have to do, en français, they say triage in it. And that's never the fun part of the job, having to not tell someone that they can't be in the festival, but there's just a limit of space. Perhaps we could just start a Canadian online queer festival.
Yes, absolutely.
So Rainbow Country airs across Canada, and Charlie, I think it was yourself that was mentioning about certain curated programming that audience will be able to see, to stream online nationwide. Can you talk to me more about that? Like, is it specifically Canadian content? How is this working, or is it short films?
Most of our Kat should jump in at one point on this, but the vast majority of our online programming is online work, and that's because it's becoming more and more impossible to show feature films. That's not our choice, so just that people know that. So all of our short films are available online. There's Canadian work in all of them. But there are two focuses in particular that are made in Canada, and there's also a Quebec focus, a Quebec program. And perhaps for the rest, you could jump in, Kat.
Mm-hmm. As I said, the Made in Canada focus, which does include short film programming, documentary, and features, usually this year Interestingly, we are not going to be showing the features virtually, only in cinema, but the roster of short films, which will be available pan-Canada, it is, as Charlie said, yes, within, I've made a real conscious decision to include as much Canadian work across the board this year, in particular in our shorts programming. That isn't necessarily the focus of Mado Canada, so across the board in all shorts. And those, the Canadian Mado Canada is available pan Canada, and those specific programs are two, you know, a documentary program and then a narrative fiction program as well. We have a few documentaries actually, one tying up with Parade, which is the NFB production, which I'm sure your audiences are really aware of. It was a pretty important document for us queers to have, you know, see our history made by our national cinema place. And I'm sure lots of folks have had an opportunity to see that across the country. We will be highlighting, you know, and routing folks towards watching that as well. We're showing Celestial Queer, which is a documentary on James McSwain, who had passed away this past September. So it's wonderful to have, to pay an homage and show a documentary that chronicles his really exciting production, his really exciting work over a number of decades. So that sort of rounds out what the across the country virtual offerings are.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. So this next question is for the both of you, and I guess maybe Charlie, I'll start with yourself. And I've had both Breton Hanam and Maurice Gale on the show at separate times, and they've both spoken about the challenges when it comes to making queer films in Canada, especially when it comes to funding and being turned down because things were too gay. And, you know, wanting to change, you know, content, that queer content in their films, that sort of thing. When it comes to queer festivals, film festivals, Charlie, what are some of the challenges that you run into time and time again? You said you've been part of this now for, 30 years? What are some of the challenges that you face year after year when it comes to putting on imagination?
Well, the first part of the answer to that is that until like four years ago, major funders did not, for the most part, fund queer film festivals. So that is more in the past, but it still represents like 33 or 4 or 5 years of our existence, which meant that we did not get the same funding. We did not get the same ability to follow progress and to develop our events as did what we call general festivals. So that's been a major, major barrier. Since a few years, that has changed. But that also means that we have all this catching up to do. And the funding does not reflect necessarily like what other festivals are getting because they are further on in their event development. So we have that as an issue. I'll speak for where we are in Quebec. Private funding is notoriously more difficult to get than it is in other parts of the country. I speak more. My knowledge is more of Ontario. So that's a constant issue every year, but we're mostly working on developing professional relationships with organizations and institutions, because part of what we do also is have a mission of, you know, helping further the development of queer films in Canada. Like, for example, we have a mentorship program for underrepresented emerging voices, which is meant to help people out with their first script. They don't need to be filmmakers. They can just want to be starting out in their career, this sort of thing. So we're focusing on a lot of that element, like building knowledge for people to become filmmakers or to further their career in filmmaking.
And Kat, for yourself, what are some of the challenges that you come across when it comes to programming this festival?
It is really, really interesting that you heard from both Gail and Brett about the challenges in securing funding. You know, if you don't have funding, you can't have a film. You know, it's pretty simple equation in particular when if you're working on large scale productions as those two were with feature length films. And yeah, absolutely. What Charlie sort of said, they're up until say 5 or so years ago, there really wasn't an awareness or at least a need to recognize, you know, issues around diversity. And I mean, like broad from funding bodies. And so that would reflect in what films got funded and also what festivals got funded. So as diversity and inclusion initiatives emerged with the major Canadian funders, so too were, you know, great filmmakers like Brett and Gail able to secure financing to make these features. And that available funding has helped us on the festival, on the exhibition side, to begin the catch up, as Charlie said, compared to our peers in similar, you know, general, I'll use your term, I would say non-queer, but that's, I think, better to go with general festivals, you know, so the playing field is not even, and we are having to do a lot of catch up. And from it, you know, not at all dismissing, having funding is pretty wonderful. And what we've been able to do with access to these two funds and these means is develop things like what Charlie mentioned, the Story Lab initiative, you know. So given the tools, we have been able to further our mission, further our mandate, include more and more wonderful works, move into helping to, you know, start near the bottom to try to get stories made, to amplify underrepresented queer voices. So, you know, it helps us all out. Money is power in some ways, you know, good and bad.
I assume that most people don't know this because it's a festival knowledge thing. During COVID, I don't know, something happened, not something happened. During COVID, a lot of major organizations took this time to really rethink and revamp their program. So diversity became a very important factor, as it should be. This also means that we now have more competition with other film festivals. So that can be a bit of a challenge to us, where now general festivals are highly encouraged to show the diversity that they didn't necessarily include before in their festivals. And I say this because I would love to just ask for your audience members, if a film is playing, if a queer film is playing in a general festival in your city, and as well will be coming, you can pretty much assume it will come to the queer festival, please go see it at the queer festival, to encourage us and to encourage like filmmakers to be part of this very, very important network of festivals that are there for them and represent them specifically. That would be great if you could do that. Thank you.
Bravo. Well put, Charlie.
So I want to talk about this a little bit more when it comes to films, queer films, and film festivals, because in some of the titles that I've mentioned that have been on Rainbow Country, they've been at other, whether regular film festivals, whether it's TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, or a queer film festival like Inside Out. So how is that an issue where it's almost a little bit incestuous, where you see the same thing popping up time and time and time again, whether it's a good film or not? It's like, you know, it's doing the film festival circuit scene. Kat, for yourself as a programmer, is that an issue?
I don't think it is an issue. I think it is just simply a reality of the fact that, you know, sorry for the Bing, across the board. There are hundreds, thousands of film festivals that exist across the globe, and there is a finite amount of work produced each year. And in particular, we speak about queer cinema and queer festivals, and in particular Canadian, within the Canadian cultural landscape, the pool, you know, you can see the brackets getting smaller and smaller. So it is a limited pool. So a film,
but if you say, but I don't mean to cut you off, but I don't mean to cut you off. But if you say that, you know, you have to sometimes turn down films, maybe an option could be to access those films that you want to turn down instead of taking the ones that are picked over and over again.
That moves into
We're speaking mostly, I said that mostly referring to short films. There's not a very large production films throughout the world, especially in Canada, especially in Montreal. So that they're two very different topics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And the feature films, they are queer films. Why would we not include them in our festival? Ideally, they would. Filmmaking is a business. It's not a conscience. So what would be the real solution to this is that distributors choose to have their films in a queer film festival rather than a larger festival that will give them more visibility.
Here's my last question, and it's again for the two of you, and Charlie, I'll start with yourself. What do you hope audiences come away with after partaking, whether it's virtual or in person, at the 38th edition of the Imagination Film, a cultural festival?
What they come away with? Well, they'll come away with a whole bunch of new stories and new, hopefully, like a new vision of the world and new perspectives of the world. And having seen themselves on screen in every year in more and more of the multiplicities that we are. So to me, that's empowerment. And that's, I guess, the one word that I would like for people to leave with at the festival.
And Kat, for yourself?
You see, Charlie stole a little bit of the power, the political thunder. I absolutely have to underline completely all of those things. We really believe, and I believe in the power of queer film and the power of queer film festivals, because representations are political. They are powerful. Seeing yourself reflected is, you know, it is a political act. It is also an act of awareness, of self actualization. The power is infinite. You know, there are more words, more adjectives I could add to that. It is essential to all things in many, many ways. And I think the power of queer cinema to take us there, and what we are able to do when we see reflections and stories, either sharing stories, being the maker and the teller of those stories, or the shower or exhibitor of those stories, it's, you know, there's magic in that. There's power in that. There's like strength in that, you know. And as we unfortunately find ourselves where we are in terms of what is happening around us, you know, politically, culturally, I think that is ever more essential. You know, it is activism as well.
Well said. Kat Setzer, Charlie Boudreau, well said, well done, well curated. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. It's a great conversation. Thank you.
That was my spotlight on the Queer Film and Cultural Festival, Image Plus Nation, or more commonly known, Imagination. For more information, simply visit image-nation.org. Coming up next, The Captive.
Hi, I'm Agnes. My new record, Magic Still Exists, is out now. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
So as you may know, Rainbow Country is an award-winning gay radio show that's heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as a podcast. The broadcast outlets that carry Rainbow Country are listener-supported. They rely on donations to help keep the lights on and the airwaves broadcasting. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of Rainbow Country, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry this little gay show. How can you do that? Well, simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and hit the donations banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that broadcast Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support, especially for independent queer radio, heard.
I'm Billy Newton Davis, and we're sitting here on Rainbow Country with the fabulous Mark Tara.
Alejandro Amenabar, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Your new film, in English, The Captive. How do you say it? What's the original title?
Yes, it, in Spanish is El Cautivo. In English, the translation, literal translation, would be The Captive.
You direct this film, you produce this film, you wrote this film, you did the musical score for this film. Talk to me about essentially the story that you're telling in The Captive.
Well, it's the story of Miguel de Cervantes, who was a writer who did Don Quixote of La Mancha. I was curious about his story and tried to learn about his personality, because at some point I wondered, this guy who ended up writing one of the most famous novels in time, what kind of guy this would be. So I didn't want just to do the typical biopic. He was born, he grew up, he died. I wanted just to focus in a part of his life, trying to get to know his soul. So that was my process during all these years.
How long did it take you to make this film?
Since I started seriously writing the script, that was like 2 years ago, although I started to research about him 8 years ago. So let's say that the production of the film has taken me 2 years. And it's been a good process. Well, we had some financial problems at some point, but I was able to keep my freedom in order to tell this story with no restriction at all.
Religion plays a big part of this story. Finding religion, holding on to religion, losing religion, converting from one religion to the other. My understanding of yourself is you were raised Catholic, mm-hmm. and then became agnostic, and then became
an atheist.
An atheist. So your personal spiritual journey, religious journey, did that influence you wanting to make this particular film?
I think that religion is all over the places, with in different levels. But in Spain, of course, we are a country where Christianity had a lot of influence, and I was raised in a religious school, so I was pretty familiar. I'm pretty familiar with all the dogmas, and I remember since I was a child, I started to question some of those dogmas and to question myself, and that of course has been in my work. Somehow, I wouldn't say that this movie is trying. I did this movie trying to talk about religion, but it is true that when you look back at the story of Cervantes and this particular time in his life, he had to deal with his greatest enemy in that prison where he was captured in the 16th century in Algiers, and he was a priest who accused him of being a sodomite. So I understood that religion was going to be part of this story, because it was in real life.
Okay, so you started making films when you were fairly young, like I believe in your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And you made your third film, I guess, in your late 20s, early 30s?
I think my third film must have been The Others.
Others.
Because that movie took us a while, because Nicole Kidman had an injury in her knee when she was doing Moulin Rouge, so we have to wait for a few months more. So I think I started it in my late 20s, of course.
So you just said Nicole Kidman, one of the producers, Tom Cruise, another one, Harvey Weinstein,
mm-hmm.
the Weinstein Corporation, the brothers. Back in 2001, looking back from where you are now, what did that experience teach you about making films, like especially being part of, you know, the big Hollywood machine, like Tom Cruise being one of the producers, Harvey Weinstein, Nicole Kidman, dealing with, you know, the top of Hollywood? What did that teach you back then?
That I was that I was pretty mad.
You were mad.
I must have been, in order to deal with them, almost sometimes without realizing how powerful they are, and that's something undeniable. They are so, I'm talking about particularly about Tom and Nicole, they're so talented, and for me I was a child, really. I was a kid, and I had to learn about the process of how things go in Hollywood, because I never wanted The Others to be a Hollywood picture. I wanted to keep control of the story that I wanted to tell. And sometimes you have little fights, sometimes or battles, sometimes you have bigger battles. But the thing that led me all the time wasn't even my future as a filmmaker. I just was focused on the story that I wanted to tell. And of course, working with someone as Nicole, who is so incredibly talented, I learned a lot about directing actresses, directing actors, and even directing stars, why not saying. For me, it was a really, really very, very intense experience.
Intense good? Intense both good and bad?
Well, in intense experiences, you have dark moments, and I have to deal with that, but it makes you stronger. So I'm when I look back, I'm surprised that little kid was able to make his point sometimes when we have some cue battles taking place.
So The Others, I love that film. I own that film, just so that you know. Okay, 2005, Best International Feature Film, and the Oscar goes to you. Talk to me about The Sea Inside and winning the Oscar for Best International Feature. Did you go into that thinking that you might win? Were you surprised? When they called your name, mm-hmm. and the film, what went through your mind?
Well, I have to say first that winning an Oscar is because it's like in such an iconic award that is something that we all dream about, especially if you're a kid as I was, obsessed with movies, and at some point you see yourself holding an Oscar, but then the reality arrives to your life and you see how difficult and tricky that is. I don't think I was thinking on an Oscar when I decided to tell this story after having made the others, tell this apparently little story, real story about this guy who was asking for euthanasia because he was quadriplegic. And I did it with all my mind, with all my heart. I really loved the story and I wanted to do a very emotional movie. And at some point we found ourselves in the route towards the Oscar. I remember you have to go there to Los Angeles. You have to be at the meetings. You have to present your movie.
You have to campaign.
You have to campaign, and that's a lot of work. And that's really what weighs on your shoulders when you're about to be at the ceremony, because you think, oh my God, after all the efforts, we might not win. But then I think it's important not only winning, but learning how to lose. That was one of those great moments when I was the fortunate among those five directors who got the Oscar. But I think I've learned in time that it's important to let it go, an award, when you simply don't get it. I don't remember what I thought when they called my name. I think I was so anxious and so, I don't know, that I just got there and said by heart all the speech that I've learned by heart at that moment.
Did winning the Oscar change your life?
No, I think, as I said, it's such an iconic award that gives you some consideration from people around you, people in the industry. But let's say that I didn't allow it to change my life, because my life was always Madrid in Spain, being surrounded by my relatives, my friends, and being able to tell my stories wherever they take me. Sometimes I have to go. I came here to Toronto to shoot the story, and I've been also in Malta shooting another story. So I just focus on my movies and try to stay aware of all that might surround the Oscars fever.
So, needless to say, you are a very successful filmmaker. You are an Oscar winner. Your films have explored themes like identity, morality, sexuality. You're also an openly gay man, and you're a filmmaker. Do you feel more comfortable today telling stories, LGBT stories, queer stories, in your films today than, say, maybe you did in 2005 or 2001? Do you feel more comfortable telling a story and showing what you're showing, especially in The Captive, today than maybe you would have like 20 years ago?
The thing is, there is like fine for me irony in this, and that is that I decided to come out of the closet, let's say, when I was in my 30s, because I was very reluctant for people to get involved in my private life, but at the same time, I don't feel bad about it. So I wanted to be open about it. I thought it was better to saying it then than when I'm 80 years old, you know, saying, oh, I was gay. I think it was important to say that at that moment, and also because it can help some other people to come out and tell to their parents, for instance. So I thought it was important to say it. But I didn't feel the call in my movies to express it. And that's why there was almost no gay characters or gay plots in my movies before. Sometimes my gay friends or even journalists said, why, what are you waiting for in order to tell a gay story? And I said, it's not something that I feel like doing. But exploring the life of Miguel de Cervantes, I found this very important element in his story. And then I thought, okay, now it's the moment. I feel totally connected with what's going on to him. And having run away from it would have been denying my own nature. So I thought that was, to now it was the moment to openly talk about homosexuality.
Do you think you could have made this film, like, say, 10 years ago? Especially with the gay aspect of it.
What I wonder is whether it will be possible to do it in 15 years in the future. Because, sometimes you can feel that things are changing and not for better. I would like to think that, at least in Spanish society, 15 years ago, of course, there would have been maybe more controversy, because he's an Spanish icon, as our best, our most important writer. But I would like to think that I would have been able to produce it and to do it. Homophobia exists in every time, in every place, at least something's a hint of it, but it exists. And in this movie, it's going to be a good, I don't know if you use the same word here, thermometer, you know, to see if sexual diversity is normal in our society. We'll see what happens.
Okay, so here's my last question for you, and it's three quick questions. Basically, one-word answers, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Red or white?
White.
Day or night?
Day.
The sea inside or the captive?
The sea inside. Okay. Yeah, I thought you were going to say The Sea Inside or The Others, which are my two favorite films and the most.
Oh, okay.
And that would have been a tricky question because I don't know which one I like the better.
Okay, so then The Sea Inside or The Others, which one do you like better?
Since I'm in English-speaking land, I would say The Others.
I have to say thank you so much for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Alejandro Amenábar's The Captive is part of this year's 38th edition of Imagination. Don't forget, there will be a curated playlist of films at this year's Imagination Film Festival that will be available to stream across Canada. For more information, simply visit image-nation.org.
Phone rings. I get a message from the mayor. He's going to call me back the next day. I get the call and he said, if you'd accept, we'd like to honor you with the key to the city. There was an event later that year in May. Just a key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but it's history. So a reporter wants to talk to me and says, so it's key, right? Like, what's the big deal? I said, well, not everybody gets the key. So I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, female impersonator Craig Russell.
Oh, Leviticus, for it is written, brethren and sistren, there is hope for all who have gone astray. Hey, hey, cabaret.
Depth of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.